Good morning, everyone. Good morning. Section one, I know you've already gotten to see me this morning. Section two, welcome to Chem 1C. I apologize you didn't have much warning, but we are not going over the syllabus in here. We are actually having our first full day of lecture today. So if you don't have anything to take notes on, you might want to get some paper and a pen from a neighbor. And then for section two, we will discuss the syllabus, everything relating to grades and schedule and lab when we get to lab this afternoon. Was there anybody that was not in attendance in the lab this morning? Specifically, is Kyle here? I'm asking only because there are anxious people on the wait list hoping to get in the course, but I am giving everyone a break on the first day to try to see what has happened to them before I give up anyone's spots. I saw that you raised your hand. Okay. So nobody else from section one. Section two, there is a wait list. I'm imagining that there may be a full class, but we will handle all registration issues when we get to the lab. So I'm going to ask for the moment that you save any questions about registration until we get to lab. I would like to go ahead and start lecture then, so you can get an idea of the style that I'm going to be teaching in, and also get us geared up to be ready to start the quarter, because I know what happens over the break, because I used to be a student a long, long time ago. And over the break, everything that you had crammed into your head starts leaking out your ears over just that couple of weeks. So we need a little bit of warm-up. And so what I'd like to start with are these two molecules. Water and ethane. Ethane, a simple hydrocarbon, a compound that contains only carbon and hydrogen. It is a simple organic compound in that it does contain carbon. We then also have water, one of the most ubiquitous substances on the planet. Water at room temperature has what phase? It's a liquid. Anybody happen to know what ethane is at room temperature? It's a gas, okay? If we very approximate it, we could say that the molar mass of water is about 18 grams per mole, oxygen being 16, hydrogen each one being 1. Then for ethane, each carbon would be 12, so times 2, that's 24, plus the 6 hydrogens we have there. We have that the molar mass is more like 30 grams per mole. So here's a question for you. Why is it that water, which is a less massive molecule, is able to be a liquid at room temperature, but the heavier molecule, ethane, is a gas? Okay, so I heard a couple of answers. If I can have someone very loudly and confidently give me an answer. Polarizability is related. Actually, it's more correct to say polar. The fact that there is charge distribution on one of the molecules. You had your hands raised. Hydrogen bonding, which is a form of dipole-dipole interaction, something that I believe that you touched upon in Chem 1B. Yes, so we're going to be starting there this quarter because we're going to be talking about solutions in which interactions between molecules involving these things called intermolecular forces are very important. What I wanted to do is to talk about these two molecules a little bit more in depth so that we can understand why is it that water is a polar molecule, a very polar molecule, and that's why it is able to be a liquid at room temperature, while ethane happens to be a non-polar molecule, which can be the explanation for why it is a gas at room temperature instead. So what I'd like to start with is the root of this behavior, which is electronegativity. Could someone give me a definition for what electronegativity is? Yes? The affinity for electrons. In what situation? Bonding. Exactly. So electronegativity is the tendency of an atom to draw electron density towards itself when it is part of a bond. by the way, section two, you don't know this yet, but these notes that I'm writing, I will be scanning and posting as a PDF to the course website, which did become active just this morning. And I am recording this lecture as well, the audio of it, and I'll be generating an MP3 file, which I'll also be posting to the website later on. So electronegativity is a tug of war. If you have two different atoms, then one of them is going to be pulling harder on the electrons that are part of that bond than the other. If I draw a real simplified cartoonish picture of the periodic table, in which directions does electronegativity increase? You're pointing that way, which means to the right, and which other direction? Up, correct. So electronegativity, which I'm frequently going to abbreviate as EN, increases towards fluorine, which is the most electronegative element. We're going to ignore the noble gases in most of our discussions because they're too good for anybody else. That's why they're called noble gases. It's not that they can't react. There are compounds that include noble gases. Just as a spot check, what's the definition of a compound? Oh, it hasn't been too long since Chem 1A that we've forgotten the simple things, is it? What's a compound versus a molecule? Oh, no, that's a rather important definition. Can anybody give me an example of a compound that's not a molecule? Not necessarily. No, that's the tricky part of it. So sodium chloride, for example, is a compound, but there's no molecule of sodium chloride because if you look at the structure of sodium chloride, table salt, it's a cubic arrangement where every other position is a sodium, then a chlorine, then a sodium, and a chlorine in any direction. So there's no one little unit of sodium chloride you can pick out and call that a molecule. A molecule would be something that is covalently bound, is something that is its own individual unit. So water is a molecule. Hydrogen gas, H2, is also a molecule, but it's not a compound, because a compound is any substance that is containing more than one type of element. So two or more elements have to come together in order for it to be called a compound. So I was saying that noble gases can make compounds, but we're going to ignore them. Fluorine, it's the most electronegative element, which is related to two things. The fact that it has very high ionization energy, meaning it doesn't like to lose electrons, and it has a very large magnitude for its electron affinity, meaning it really likes to gain electrons. So those two things put together means that fluorine really wins that tug of war. Let's say that we had something like water that has two very different types of atoms in it, oxygen being right next door to fluorine on the periodic table, being very electronegative, hydrogen not being anywhere near as much so. That means that the oxygen is going to draw electron density towards itself, which we're able to represent in a couple of different ways. One way is to use the symbol delta. Which means a little bit. There's a more rigorous definition of it in mathematics, but this is chemistry. So it means a partial positive charge, which is what hydrogen's going to have because it is the less electronegative element. And then that means that oxygen will have a partial negative charge. And let me highlight here, oxygen is more electronegative. Not to clutter that too much, let me redraw the molecule of water here and show another way that the dipole can be represented, which is an arrow. And I just used this term that I probably should define, a dipole. What is a dipole? Well, it is as it sounds, di meaning two, pole meaning end or position. So it's something that's two-ended, and in this case, it means something that has a separation of charge. So there's part of the molecule that's plus, part of the molecule that's minus. Magnets also come in dipoles where you have a north end and you have a south end. So a slightly technical definition that will apply for this case here is that a dipole is charge separation in space, meaning that it has a plus end and a minus end. Very importantly, it is a vector quantity. Yes, sir.
So that shouldn't there be also another one?
There is. Yes, that's right. There are two dipoles because there's two different bonds, and that's where we're leading to next, is how do those two dipoles interact with each other? So, but you're correct, yes. Now, vectors have a magnitude towards them, and they also have a direction. And it's exactly that direction component that we're going to come back to in just a moment. Polar is related. Polar is just an adjective, where dipole is the noun. So dipole is the thing, meaning the charge is separated. Something that has a dipole is polar. And so what I've displayed here so far is a bond dipole, which is caused by a difference in electronegativity of the atoms in a bond. This is distinct from a molecular dipole, and part of what we're just about to discuss is the fact you can have bonds that have dipoles, but end up with a molecule that does not have a dipole. So let me review what we've talked about so far. I know we haven't gotten very far yet, but we're discussing this very important thing, electronegativity. Electronegativity, the fact that atoms do have a difference in how hard they pull on electrons, causes bonds to have dipoles, these positive and negative ends. Why that matters, we'll get to at the end, but now I need to talk a little bit about molecules and their shape. But does anyone have any questions before I move on to the next part of our discussion? Okay, so I did mention that shape is something important, and so that means we need to very briefly review VSEPR theory. First, could someone help me out with what the acronym VSEPR stands for? Yes, very good. Valence shell electron pair repulsion. Let's break this apart. Valence shell. Why do we only care about the valence shell? Because those are the electrons that participate in bonding. They are the, well, let me ask you, what are valence electrons? Electrons that are in the outermost shell, which means they're the most energetic electrons, which explains why they're involved in bonding. So we only look at the valence shell because of those, that's the business end of an atom, you could say. Why do we worry about electron pairs? There's two answers to that, really. Why electron pairs, and then why not single electrons? Let's answer the first part first. Why do we worry about electron pairs? They do. Bonds are pairs of electrons. Why is that? Yes, sir. It's okay. Yes. Ah, so opposing spin. What filling rule from atomic structure do we know that mentions spin? You're totally on the right track. There's Hund's rule, which says that in degenerate, which means equal energy orbitals, one electron will be placed in each orbital first because there's an energy penalty for pairing up. There's the Aufbau principle, which says that electrons fill from lowest energy level up. And then there's the Pauli exclusion principle, which could be stated two different ways, which is that no two electrons can have the same four quantum numbers, or the other way to say it is that two pair of electrons can fit into one orbital as long as they have opposite spin. So the reason that we worry about electron pairs is because orbitals, the spaces around an atom or a molecule that electrons occupy, orbitals hold pairs of electrons. And yes, for the vast majority of molecules that we're going to discuss, we either have bonds, which are pairs because it's bonding orbitals, or we'll have lone pairs. Every once in a while, we'll have a molecule that has an individual electron. Does anybody happen to know what often those molecules are called when they have just one electron? Radicals. Why do we not worry about radicals when discussing Vesper theory? Because it's this last bit, the repulsion part. Like charges repel. To expand slightly, like charges try to get as far away apart from each other as possible. Two negative charges are going to have more repulsive force than an individual negative charge. So if you did have an unpaired single electron somewhere on an atom or a molecule, it doesn't impact, except for maybe a percent, the structure of that molecule because it doesn't have the repulsive force that a pair of electrons does. So putting it all together, the valence shell electrons that tend to occur in pairs will try to get as far away apart from each other as possible. That's Vesper theory. There are several shapes that you need to know in Vesper theory. We might review those as the quarter goes on. We don't need to recall all of them right at the moment. But watcher, what shape is it? Bent, which is a form of tetrahedral. So how do I know that it's in this tetrahedral class? Because it has two bonding pairs of electrons and two lone pairs of electrons. And so since we have four pairs trying to get as far apart from each other as possible, that is going to generate a particular shape, which if we had four bonds, it'd be a tetrahedron. But we don't have four bonds. We have two of them as lone pairs instead of bonds, which is why water is bent. Why does that matter? Because there is some symmetry to water. Now, math is a four-letter word, which for those of you who are ESL students, think about the words that you're not generally supposed to say in polite company in English, and realize that a very large number of those words only have four letters in them. And the word math also only has four letters in them. No offense to the math majors out there. I actually used to like math. Maybe that's why I ended up where I did. But math scares people. Well, we got to use a little bit in here. This is a computationally intensive class because we are going to do things like ice problems again this quarter. There is maybe a little bit more concept than in 1B, versus equation, so it'll be a little bit more of a mix, maybe like Chem 1A was. But the point I'm getting at is I need to talk geometry just for a minute here. Because I said that dipoles are vector quantities, so they point in a certain direction. And as was pointed out to me earlier, yes, there are two bond dipoles in water. But what I could do is break up this dipole into two components. In other words, I could talk about the fact that if this is diagonal, if this is slanted from the perspective in which I've written this axis through water, that I could talk about the projection of that dipole horizontally, and I could talk about the projection of the dipole vertically. Now, what I'm trying to show here is that in the horizontal direction, the two dipoles are exactly opposed to each other. If they're exactly opposed to each other, that means they cancel each other out. If they cancel each other out, that means there's no net displacement of electron density across a molecule, which means there wouldn't be a dipole, which means even though the bonds are polar, the whole molecule is not. But that's only if we're looking in the horizontal direction. If we're looking in the vertical direction, the two dipoles are pointing in the same direction, and so they reinforce each other. So let me try to do this without making a mess of the diagram. But these two, the horizontal projections, cancel. But the important part here is that the vertical projections reinforce each other, which leads to a molecular dipole. So it's still a dipole. It's still got two ends, a plus and a minus. But what I'm trying to say is that instead of looking just at the two bonds, we can look at the fact that there is a sum, a vector sum, that has a direction to it. So water has a plus end and a minus end. And as I said earlier, we'll get to why that matters in just a moment. Now, if there's cases where the dipoles don't balance out, just like here, then there must be a case where the dipoles do balance out. And I don't want to get lost in this, but there's a very good example that's not just a line, and that's the molecule borane. Borane is unusual because it exists, even though it can never by itself attain a full octet. We can look at it and see that it has three bonds around it, which means it's got a total of six electrons, which means it doesn't have eight, which means it's starved for electrons, which is why if you take this stuff and shoot it out into the atmosphere, you might have a flamethrower because of how violently borane tries to react with the surrounding moisture. That's a different story, though. Notice that I've written this in a triangular arrangement. Why? What is the Vesper predicted shape of borane? Trigonal planar. You have to put that planar in because, to recall, there's trigonal planar, trigonal pyramidal, trigonal bipyramidal. This is the planar version because there's only three bonds to it. So that means this has a 120-degree angle in between any two bonds, correct? All right, I will tell you that hydrogen is more electronegative than boron, because without a table or without some experience, that wouldn't be something that you would necessarily know. So we could show that there's three dipoles all pulling away from boron. Now, let me redraw this again. and do the same story about the projections. And I'll do this quick because I'm not trying to put too much math in here. Wow. Now I guess would be a good time to talk about cell phone policy. So again, I'm going to drop an axis through here that's collinear with the vertically oriented boron-hydrogen bond. If the magnitude of the vector that is vertical here is x, then again we can make projections. And given that we have a 60-degree angle here and a 30-degree angle here, using a little trig, we can find out that the horizontal projection of that is root 3 over 2x, and we can find that the vertical projection is 1/2 x. Now, since there's two vectors pointing down, there's two vectors pointing down with 1/2 x magnitude. We'll add that together, and that gives you x. If there's x pointing down and there's x pointing up, those two things cancel each other. We just saw a moment ago water, which doesn't have the exact same geometry, but has this situation where horizontally the vectors cancel with each other. If that was a lot of mathematical nonsense, then let me summarize it this way. The dipoles in boron exactly balance each other. Meaning the vector sum is zero, meaning the molecule is non-polar. Because if it balances, there's no plus end, there's no minus end. And this is the logic we use to decide, is a molecule polar or not? And in Chem 1A, you hopefully went through some exercises where you wrote down molecular structures, predicted their geometries using VSEPR, and then talked about whether or not they're polar. Now, to bring this back to the story I'm trying to tell, though, let me put back water and ethane. Water, we know, is bent, and so it is polar because it's bent. It's not just because the atoms are different in electronegativity. It's also due to the geometry. Ethane turns out to be a symmetric molecule because each individual carbon is tetrahedral, which if the atoms were all equivalent would be exactly nonpolar. There's a little polarity due to the fact that carbon and hydrogen are different from each other, but then if you look at the molecule, the whole molecule has a plane of symmetry through it, and so again, it ends up having no molecular dipole. So to summarize all of this, due to its asymmetric shape, and its strong bond dipoles, water is a very polar molecule. Second thought, due to its symmetric shape and its weak bond dipoles, ethane is a non-polar molecule. That doesn't mean it has zero attraction, because, as we will review, there are permanent dipoles, which is what I'm discussing here, but there are also temporary or induced dipoles, dipoles that don't result because of molecular structure. And those kinds of transitory dipoles, which is related, I forgot who used the word earlier, but is related to polarizability. That can cause even a non-polar molecule like ethane to have some attractive forces. But now we get to the question of, Why does it matter that these are polar and monpolar? How does that explain the difference in their physical properties? So the next thing we got to talk about is, what is heat? Energy. What kind? Kinetic. Who said that? Correct. What kind of kinetic energy? Can you describe it a little bit? Of what? So more specifically, it would be the bonds vibrating, wiggling, rotating, or the molecules themselves moving around. In other words, it's motion of the atoms or molecules inside of a substance of some sort. So what is it that causes molecules to not fly apart from each other then? If molecules have all this wiggling that's going on, what's counteracting that? Yes? Intermolecular forces. IMF, not the International Monetary Fund. Intermolecular forces. Attractions between molecules. Due to the interaction. Of full charges, which means you have ions, or partial charges, which means you have permanent or induced dipoles. To put it in more physics terms, they're electrostatic forces, meaning that plus attracts minus, minus attracts plus, like charges repel, opposite charges attract. That's what intermolecular forces are. What causes intermolecular forces? Well, we've talked about one example. Water is polar because of its structure. Because it is polar, it has strong intermolecular forces. So water has strong intermolecular forces due to its polarity, while ethane has very weak intermolecular forces due to its non-polarity. And I know that you talked about phase changes last quarter, so this is review. That's why I'm kind of sailing through it a little quickly. But water is able to be a liquid at room temperature because the intermolecular forces are strong enough to overcome thermal energy, to overcome heat, which is the wiggling of molecules. So let me define heat. It is the sum of the translational, which means it's moving around, vibrational, which means atoms are moving relative to each other, rotational, things are spinning around, motion of the atoms and or molecules in a system. And so here's the summary. Water is able to be a liquid at room temperature, RT. Because
its intermolecular forces are able to resist the effects of heat. Ethane is unable to be a liquid at room temperature. Because thermal energy overcomes ethane's weak intermolecular forces. And so where we started off with is the fact that water is a liquid at room temperature, ethane is not. And that's due to the balance of thermal energy versus kinetic energy. So I won't write it down because it's really not mathematically correct, but if you want to way simplify, you could say that the intermolecular forces are greater than the kinetic energy for water, and the kinetic energy is greater than the intermolecular forces for ethane. Now, I have a little bit more to say on the topic here, but I want to pause again to see if anyone has any questions. The question you shouldn't be asking yet is how much of this is on the exam. Because this is review. And so if some of these things are unfamiliar to you, this might be the suggestion that there's some topics from Chem 1A or Chem 1B that you might want to review, which is why we're doing this today. I know many of you have not had the chance to do it yet, but the syllabus is posted, and it does show you the sections that we're starting on Wednesday. Those sections involve intermolecular forces. So I wanted the chance to talk about intermolecular forces to give you the topics to review before we start new material. So that's the purpose of this lecture. And it might be that nothing specific from this lecture ends up on a quiz or exam. But I will clarify that before we get to any quizzes or exams. Any questions? Then I've got just a few minutes left, and I would like to talk about one last thing then. Let's say that I took water and spilt it on the benchtop here, the desktop. And let's say it wasn't very much water, a few drops or so. We all leave. No one else touches the desktop. We come back tomorrow. Is that water going to be here? Not very likely. Why would it not be here? It's going to evaporate. What is the boiling point of water? I'll ask the question again. What is the boiling point of water? Wrong answer. What's the correct answer? You're very close. What pressure am I asking about? Because boiling point changes with pressure. Someone mentioned vapor pressure. Boiling is the point at which vapor pressure from a substance equals the surrounding atmospheric pressure. Mess with the surrounding atmospheric pressure, you mess with the boiling point. So you all said 100 degrees, but if you go to Denver, that's not the right answer because the pressure is lower there, and so it boils at less than 100 degrees Celsius. So what's the standard boiling point of water? 100 degrees Celsius. Does it ever reach 100 degrees Celsius in this room? So why did water evaporate? That's because some molecules have more energy than others. So this is a diagram that you're going to be seeing in different places through the quarter. And I'm going to give it its own separate page because of it. Did anybody still need to write anything on the second page here? What I'm talking about at the moment is what's known as a molecular energy distribution diagram. Where this normally comes up
is in the kinetic molecular theory of gases. Let me draw the diagram first, and some of you might go, oh, yeah, that thing. In any graph, we should always properly label our axes. So the x-axis, in this case, is the energy per molecule. So slow-moving molecules on the left, lower kinetic energy. Fast-moving molecules on the right, higher kinetic energy. The y-axis would be number of molecules. So it's a population graph. How many slow-moving molecules are there? How many fast-moving molecules are there? The blue line represents low temperature. The red line represents high temperature. And this is a graph that's generated in classical statistical thermodynamics, where you take a set of molecules, you let them loose, they all bump into each other. Some of them start moving faster because of that. Some of them start moving more slowly. And in general, they will reach this kind of distribution. It is this distribution and the formation of it that is responsible for the e to the negative 1 over RT factor that you get in the Arrhenius expression. Yeah, we got to talk Arrhenius expression every once in a while. You do still have to know Chem 1B to be in 1C. But what's the point of this graph? Let's say that I select some energy value. Maybe it is the heat of vaporization of water, if we're talking about water evaporating. Maybe it's the activation energy in a chemical reaction. So this same graph can be used to explain two things. I'm going to describe why water's evaporating, but you could also talk about why an increase in temperature causes an increase in the rate of reaction. The two things are related. At low temperature, there is a small but non-zero portion of the molecules that are above that threshold energy. So if it takes a certain amount of energy to be able to evaporate, well, there's some molecules that will always have that energy. So if I put water out here on the desktop, the molecules that have that energy are able to evaporate. And because the room stays at a constant temperature, then this graph stays the same. More molecules gain that energy to then evaporate, and it continues and continues, and that's why water disappears. Of course, when you raise the temperature, then there's a larger fraction of molecules that are able to evaporate. So let's say this is the minimum energy needed to evaporate. Then this would be the fraction of molecules able to evaporate. This is more of a Chem 1A or Chem 1B topic, but let me point out that at low temperature, the graph is narrower. There's a bigger spike to the graph, and at high temperature, the distribution is more spread out. Of course, you notice that the average energy at higher temperature is logically higher than the average energy at lower temperature. But the shape of the graph does shift with temperature. To summarize what I've been saying in this case here, water is able to evaporate at room temperature. Even though it is not near its normal boiling point. Because a small fraction of molecules will have the energy necessary. To evaporate. And again, in your text, this might be under the heading of kinetic molecular theory. More generally, this could be called an energy distribution diagram. Part of the reason I wanted to have this discussion is so I could talk more about equilibrium. We'll have a review of equilibrium in a few more class sessions. The reason we need to talk about equilibrium is we use it in many of the topics we're going to be covering this quarter. Section 2, I will more describe the topics we're covering this quarter when we go over the syllabus. So let me one more time recap what we did this morning and then tell you a little bit where we're going next. So we talked about an example of how polarity can have an effect on physical properties. We looked at water, which is an asymmetric, very polar molecule that has strong intermolecular forces. And we looked at ethane, which is a symmetric molecule that has very minimal intermolecular forces. The more intermolecular forces there are, the more that a substance is able to stick together with itself to remain in a condensed state, which is why water is able to be a liquid at room temperature, while ethane is a gas. However, water can convert into a gas even at room temperature because there's a fraction of those molecules that have the energy to be able to evaporate. What we're going to talk about on Wednesday is the formation of solutions. And what we're going to be more specifically talking about over the next couple of class sections is the energy involved in forming a solution. Now, energy, we're going to be discussing in the form of enthalpy, which is heat at constant pressure, but we'll also be talking about free energy, which is why at some point we have to have a review of equilibrium, because free energy is directly tied with the concept of equilibrium. Both of those things are involved in electrochemistry, one of the big topics that we do in Chem 1C. So we're going to start building up to that point. Just a few last things to wrap up the lecture for today. There is going to be an electronic download version of the lab manual if you do not already have access to it from a previous class. However, there are three experiments that are not in that electronic version, one of them being the first experiment, which is the freezing point depression. So from section one, there were a couple of people asking this morning if there's an electronic version. Yes, I'll be sending a link to it, but I don't yet have the electronic version of the freezing point experiment to be able to give you a link to. So for this first experiment, if you do not already have a physical copy of the lab book, unless I'm able to get it tonight or tomorrow morning, I would strongly suggest you borrowing someone else's from the class just to photocopy those couple of pages until I am able to get you the electronic versions. Then one last note about Section 2. We will be doing all registration questions, anything to do with the wait list in there. And so that is the end of our first lecture. Thank you.